Yes, we're recording. Hello.
Hey, hello,
everyone.
Thank you very much.
Filling out the room.
It's a really good start to our live podcast show, isn't it? That's great. So, yeah, welcome. This is a very special Chips of Chorlton. We are live from the Orbit stage at Blue Dot Festival. Yay! Oh, that's a good start.
Oh, that's big.
There we go. So, yeah, so I'm your host. I'm Neil. I play guitar, session guitar for Dutch Uncles, and I am joined by three members of Dutch Uncles. We have Andy.
Hello.
Robin.
Hiya.
And Duncan.
Yo.
Yeah. Oh, Duncan gets a
clap. I was very unnerved about your pause there. I was like, what are you setting me up for?
I know. What's his name again? So has anyone listened to the podcast before?
Oh, wow.
Okay. Oh, wow, it's brilliant. So I presume you're all Dutch Uncles fans as well? Well, I was expecting there to be no one here and no one know the podcast and Dutch Uncles. That's a really, really good start.
Did you have a joke that was lined up?
Yeah, I do have a joke. So when we go and play festivals anyway, this is about the right crowd that we usually face anyway. So.
Nice one, Neil.
Yeah, cheers for that, mate.
It means so like beautiful, amazing people. Yeah,
so for people who haven't heard the podcast before, what we do is we chat about what we know best, I suppose, about music, sort of behind the scenes, music industry stuff that we've kind of want to get off our chests, yeah. Would you say?
Sorry, it sounds really bitter.
I know, it does sound. And we talk about chips, basically, and the chips that are around in and around Chorlton, really.
We're assuming you're all from Chorlton because this is Blue Dot Festival. That's not a...
No, no one's from Chorlton.
Not a criticism of the festival. Just assuming geographically speaking.
But we assume you're all like chips.
Yeah,
Who doesn't like a chip?
And we added the chips to give the podcast some geography, but also the phrase, the chips of Chorlton, is an interesting phrase for somebody who thinks they're all that and definitely worthy of a podcast, hence this.
We are the chips of Chorlton. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so as this is a special episode, live, our first live one, we thought we'd bring a special guest. There's an empty chair here. So... yeah, without further ado, we'll bring on from Public Service Broadcast, Jay Wilgus, Esquire. Woo!
Come on, Wills. The juggernaut.
Can we shake? Hello?
There we go.
Hi.
Doing the Graham Norton thing.
We've never met before. Hi.
Hello.
How does this feel?
It's nice, isn't it?
It's a very strange thing for us, like on a fifth episode, like it's only our fifth time doing this. I keep getting the Batman line in my head. You either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become a villain. And this is something we've always threatened to do. Whenever someone gives us like a really terrible fee for a support tour, it's like, we'll give you £50 a show. It's like, well, the Dutch Uncles package for £50 a show is four chairs, four mics, and a few jokes for half an hour.
Just tell some depressing anecdotes.
But yourself, you've done like TED Talks and all that.
It was TEDx.
TEDx.
Is that very important?
Is that kind of like the digital radio version of TED Talk?
It means you're not in the club. Yeah, you're not in the club.
It's not official.
Yeah, that was a bit weird, but it was nice to be asked, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, so you're in the middle of sort of second year of the Every Valley campaign.
Yes.
Building up to a sold-out show at the Royal Albert Hall. Is that something you kind of had earmarked, sort of, I suppose, post-Brixton for you? Was that in the back of your mind, the next step up?
I think it had been discussed with, you know, managers and booking agents for a while, because Brixton's sort of 5,000, in terms of options either above or below that, there aren't really actually that many in London. You either make a massive jump up to, like, Alexandra Palace or go somewhere horrible like Wembley Arena. And we're nowhere near big enough for all that stuff, so we thought Albert Hall would be lovely if we can get it. But Albert Hall was booked up for a year and a half in advance normally, so we only got this date because somebody else cancelled. I don't know who it was.
Wow,
and even then, three people went for it, and you will have to sort of make your case for why you're the one who deserves a gig at the Albert Hall, and for some reason they gave it to us. So, yeah, it should be really, you know, it's the Royal Albert Hall, I think. We were there recently for Robin Ince's Space Shambles thing they did with Commander Hadfield, and he's got all these posters backstage that say the world's most famous stage, and like a natural skeptic, I was like, come on, the world's most famous stage, and actually start thinking about it, it might be. Is it? Like Madison Square Garden, maybe, but...
I don't know, Red Rocks, is that up there, maybe?
It's definitely up there, isn't it? I think I withdrew my skepticism. I was like, okay, fair enough. Yeah, especially when you see the pictures of who they had there, it's just... incredible.
I suppose we discussed, you've been there once, haven't you?
Yeah, we went to see composer Steve Reich play his 75th birthday there. Fantastic show. And we've spoken about this on the podcast. Unfortunately, it was marred when, by the end of the show, like, I had a really emotional time listening to Music for 18 Musicians. It was really sort of introspective, closed my eyes, like, that was brilliant. Sort of head up from this trance, and then someone had broken wind during the last few bars.
And we were in a private box.
And so now,
as well.
whenever I listen to the last bit of Music for 18 Musicians by Steve Reich, I just smell crap.
Oh, dear.
It was a really sick, like, stench.
And yeah. Also, like, smell memories stay with you longer than, like, yeah. visual or aural. So, yeah, that smell, yeah, like you say, whenever we hear that piece of music.
No one's going to do that at your show, by the way.
unless you invite us to the
can
box,
I ask,
basically.
Neil, how long have we been going until the first fart joke came out?
Yeah, 7 like, minutes in, we've
kind of had a stopwatch going on there.
So the Albert Hall show sold out within a week, was it? A few days as well?
It was much quicker than we were expecting, yeah, which is lovely. I think it's because of the venue.
I think you might have something to do with it as well, you know.
50-50.
If you take it on a purely statistical, evidence-based thing, like looking at how long it's taken to sell Brixton and Hammersmith, there's no way it should have sold that quickly. I think it is because, you know, it is one of the world's most famous venues, and a lot of people are probably going to travel for it, and it's kind of a special occasion for everyone, hopefully, and especially us.
Yeah. Maybe we should play it.
That's a good idea. On that
set, it'd sell out, wouldn't it?
Yeah, probably would.
Or just do this.
Yeah, do this.
Can we do this? Can you be in it as well?
Yeah. Well, if Dad wrote a porno, we can get there. You know.
Yeah,
we'll give us 18 months.
So we're really interested on Twitter, and you tweeted something about receiving some disgruntled fans who couldn't get tickets. And I think your tweet was absolutely spot on. I think it's a really weird part of being in a band that, you know, you try your best to accommodate your fans as much as possible, but unfortunately, for shows like that, not everyone is going to come in. And you kind of voiced that on Twitter, didn't you?
It's a really hard balance to strike because, you know, I don't want to be one of these bands who never engage with anybody online and sort of try and stay aloof and as if, you know, you're not. If somebody asks you a question, you're too important to answer that. Like, no, we came up sort of via very much sort of DIY ethos and DIY ethic, and so that's still kind of imbued in us, and so we still are very accessible, very open, very engaged online, and I think sometimes people kind of forget that it's us, you know, and they have goes at us for all sorts of things that are way, way beyond our control. And it's just, I appreciate the frustration, you know, I know how frustrating it is. I mean, try myself, if you're online at 9 a.m. and they've all gone by 9:05, but some people really do just chuck the sort of kitchen sink at you, and it's not really fair, so you just have to politely remind them of that.
Yeah, and that's what again, I sort of want to talk about Twitter and bands and music, etc. And you're very vocal. I think it's great. I really enjoy reading your tweets, and especially you do that. It's kind of semi-dangerous for an artist to do, is to get into politics and voice your opinions on things.
You thought it was going to be about chips,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, sorry, you thought it was a chips podcast. Sorry.
Oh, God.
It's a dead
rumble.
Is that a conscious decision? Have you sort of thought, should I be doing it? When you first wrote that tweet that you're going, I'm putting my flag up here, I am this type of person. Is that a...
I think so, yeah. I don't want to make too much of what Brixton was for us, but, you know, I grew up in Southwest London. I went to so many shows there, seen so many great gigs and a lot of terrible ones as well. And that was always like, that's the peak, that's the dream. And I didn't think we'd ever get a chance to do that. And I didn't think, I didn't think it would even be on the cards. So to have got there and done it and played the sort of show that we did, it just kind of made us sort of take stock a bit, really, and think about what we're doing, why we're doing it, what kind of band we want to be. Do you just want to kind of try and move further up festival billings and get bigger and bigger and bigger, or do you actually want to, you know, do you want to try and use your platform and use your voice to actually say something? And I think the third album, you know, the leap from the Space Race to Coal Mining in South Wales is definitely part of that, trying to sort of tell a more human story and a more political story. And I guess if you're making that kind of music and if you're making those kind of statements, it's a natural progression that you're going to end up sort of voicing certain opinions on Twitter about that.
Yeah, I suppose to counteract that, Dutch Uncles, I obviously I know you very well, and I know your which way you lean politically. You've kind of shied away from that somewhat, haven't you?
Yeah, no, we crap ourselves the second we ever tweet anything that's remotely political.
Oh, because yeah, it's
we just kind of like okay? to yeah, yeah. stay
It's
away
like a four hands up democratic vote before any tweet goes out.
Yeah, no, big time. And I think we feel that it's not that we feel like we have a, you know, like a very fragile audience size or anything like that, but it kind of feels like certainly, it's strange. Like I think anyone who's into sort of, you know, the prog rock audiences, whatever. Like, I suppose you could say that our music does apply to an audience group that's slightly above our age. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's also below as well. But at the same time, it's like older music fans know that young bands and bands in general are going to have left-leaning sort of philosophies to their music and the way that they live their, you know. Because, yeah, we've managed to get to 30 without having a job. This is great. Like, we work 2 till 5, right? We got a very much more relaxed and, I don't know, liberal approach to how we go about our business and everything else, and we feel like it should. But we just don't want to tweet about it because there's no point. We'd just rather tweet Pete in a funny hat, if we can. He's not here for...
It is funny.
It was funny, yeah. So the review you got from The Guardian with Big Balloon as well is that they picked up on some of the political elements in your music as well that are very sort of hidden. I remember, what was it? I think it was down...
There was a song on our latest album that kind of looked at austerity, the life of living under austerity, which is, it was a song about my uncle who died of a terminal illness whilst he was on benefits. And it was more just sort of a portrayal in the way that he was living his life and the mentality he was under, whilst at the same time that very section of society was getting hated on, you know, in the press, along with immigrants as well. Like, you know, he was just seen as a scrounger, and yet he was living in absolute misery. So I tried to put that into a song that was a bit more social. Yeah, there was a social commentary to that song, but the lyrics were so abstract, I think, half the time anyway, that it didn't... I don't think it... I always try and make every song about three things, or two or three things. So if anyone ever kind of cottons onto something like that, I'd be like, oh, no, it wasn't about that. It's just about fart jokes or something like that. Or it was actually about a plane. Well, it's called Same Plane Dream.
That Guardian review also, it compared it to Sleaford Mods, didn't it?
Yeah, but that's just because we kind of... compare them to Sleaford Mods, and then they followed us.
Well, then it was the most unlikely of bromances with Sleaford Mods.
Got it,
yeah. Turns out they're big fans of us.
Yeah, yeah. We did get, like, a few really sort of, like, gushing tweets from I think, the singer.
Yeah.
And then we asked them if they... This was the end of last year. And we asked them if they wanted to do a Christmas song with us. That would be really good, like, austerity Christmas. Something like that, you know.
You always call it Bag of Cans,
bag
didn't you?
Bag of cans
at Christmas.
They're all working titles. Could have been any of them. Austerity Christmas,
there's
brackets,
so much
Bag of Cans.
There's so much more tape over all that.
But I don't think he quite got it. Like, it was going to be ironic, but he was just like, oh, no, I don't think we're quite there yet.
Yeah,
I don't
they
think
basically
we could
said,
do that.
Flat no, we're not doing anything like that.
I know, they were still so affectionate towards us as a band, and we were like, have you seen the tweet of Pete in Funny Hat? Like, I'm not sure you've got the whole picture.
So, I suppose to just wrap up a Twitter piece. So, Twitter uses promotion now, and I really want to talk... because we're going to a festival crowd, and I want to talk about Morrissey for 2 seconds, if I may.
We should say at this point, I did say it before we started recording, but other people have walked in the room. Hello. If you have any questions about anything we're talking at any point, put your hand up,
and we'll be like,
what's your problem?
So obviously Morrissey joined Twitter to promote his new record. So, and I don't think he really tweets, but obviously I think if he did it would, we know what sort of content would be in there. So I suppose... I'm really interested to see, are there any Smiths fans here? Or any fans of the Smiths, or have been
this
in their life?
This is pre-Morrissey outburst.
Pre-Morrissey, any Smiths fans. If the Smiths got together and did another show, would you go to see them? Raise your hands for that. Yeah? That's interesting. Yeah. I suppose going back to Twitter, Mark Riley tweeted, he played, what's the Queen?
He played The Queen Is Dead
Queen
on
is
his
dead.
Show recently.
And he said, I'm playing this because of Mar and Rourke, etc., they are not horrible people, if you like. So I'm going to play it for them.
I don't know. We met Andy Rourke once, and it was a very checkered affair.
Okay.
Not politically speaking, he drank our rider. It's like, never meet your heroes, because when you meet them, they'll drink your rider. And then they'll alienate. It was the only gig we did in New York, at New York Sound City, and he was like the main support band. We were headlining it. We were supposed to be supporting the Lars, and they dropped out 7 days before the gig. Yada, yada, yada. Absolute shitstorm. We'll talk about that in the next podcast, probably. Their band went on before us, and it was the most anti-American set possible. And about half the crowd left during their first song alone. So not only did they thin the audience, but they also drank our rider.
Maybe they drank the bar dry as well.
Yeah. But other than that, he's a good bassist.
Okay, so... So we're going to talk about festivals, as you know, as we're at one. I tweeted a video of
your first Glastonbury performance.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that video existed.
I know, I was doing my research, and we were thinking festival theme, where did you start off? Williams Green stage, is that...
Yep, right? I think we were on after Everything. This is 2013, it was a Sunday night, and I think it had been a very dry and quite cheery Glastonbury, so everyone was in quite a good mood, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose, looking at that video, your stage show has changed dramatically in that time, and we saw it because we were touring Out of Touch in the Wild at the same time you were touring for your first record in 2013, would that
yeah,
be?
I think we were on like the same sort of...
Yeah, we played
circuit.
We played Kendall, no, Stan Corlin in Festival
yes,
6,
yeah,
didn't we?
Yeah.
As we recall, you nicked our drum riser for one of your screens.
Oh yeah, the big telly took my drum riser. Never forgiven you for that.
We never forget. Man, and you know what front
man
is.
Oh yeah,
right,
true.
And then 2 years later, 2015, we saw you at Kendall Corlin, and the whole... Everything seemed to have changed for you over the 2 years, and as far as the stage show goes, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it was something we always wanted to kind of build up to, but you know, when you're touring in a splitter van and budgets are tight, you have to kind of live within your means. And so for Glastonbury, it was just the two of us, and we would have had our first sort of wooden TV screen that came in two halves. You had to put the top half in the bottom half, and then stretch this kind of projection fabric and pin it in with drawing pins around the back. And you know, it's all very low tech. And then 2 years later, I think we'd probably added the brass section more permanently by then. And, you know, we'd added JF Abraham playing bass for this as well. So it's all kind of starting to expand musically. And then, you know, if you're kind of moving up the bill, you do get slightly better production at festivals. So you can put on more sort of visual show as well and you know, use the lights more. All these kind of things all kind of scale up. And I think it just really kind of heightens the impact of what you're already doing.
Yeah, it did. I suppose I remember that Kendall Corlin show. I think I was very drunk. I think I hugged you when you came on stage.
Our guitar tech was the most drunk man in the whole festival. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And we left at get in our very small kind of van, and you had this really huge kind of tour bus, and we went, hang on, 2 years ago, they were like...
Still in my riser.
Oh, no, yeah.
Yeah. It happens, yeah.
It did. We got lucky, you know, especially with... I think the luckiest we've ever got is with writing Go... And it just came out in like 15 minutes, and it's the most confident I've ever been about a song, and I just felt like this is gonna do something, and thankfully I was right. But
it's a great song.
You never know when you're gonna get lucky with something like that, and thankfully we did. So.
But that's I suppose the good side of festivals. We always talk about like a Dutch uncle's low light on every episode, of which there are many. But do you have any particular festival low lights, like some embarrassment? You know,
yeah,
totally.
I mean, how long have you got?
The worst one, or the top two?
Shoot from your hip.
I mean, in the very early days, we got booked to play this psychedelic trance festival down in Somerset, which is a good start. And then we got there, and they didn't have the drum kit stuff they said they'd have, and they tried to offer us as a snare stand a barbecue. So, yeah, that was good. And for some reason there, we went down all right, actually. It was in this tiny little tent, and we thought...
The barbecue that made it.
Yeah, it was, you know...
Smoky Tombra.
Special gigs. And we thought, we've only got one song left we can do as an encore, so we went back on and did the first song off The War Room, which is If War Should Come, which is pretty gloomy.
Yeah.
And it just killed the whole mood. It was terrible.
Wasn't very psyche.
No, it was like, oh, well, bye, everyone. And off we went, yeah.
I was going to say, you must have had some visual hiccups at some point. Especially in a festival setting as well, when there's just no time for error. I think every, no matter how experienced a band you are, whatever your first festival is of any festival circuit, no matter what album you're on, the first one is always such a shocker, such a jolt of reality when you realise we've got like 10 minutes to get ourselves like ready to go here. And if you're not ready, because it's not a usual gig. So like the fact that you've got the visual thing as well, all I got to do is just stick dancing shoes on. So like,
yeah, there's a lot to get going. There is an awful lot that can go wrong. You know, it's a bit, I immodestly compare it to space flight. There are a million things that could go wrong. And you know, going back to, you know, we made reference at the start to the sort of TEDx talk that I did, was about building in a bit of the potential to fail in live music and not making it too on rails and not making it too comfortable, so that you do have this element of danger. And possibly we've gone too far the other way with that, and there are too many things that could fail at any one time. So it can make it a little bit hard to just relax and enjoy the show sometimes. Like, I've got so many experiences, I think I've just tried to black out my mind because they've just been too terrible or embarrassing. But, yeah. But I mean, the Belfast gig we did recently for the biggest weekend for the BBC, you know, terrified because the first four songs were new and it's the first time we'd ever played them, and, you know, we'd rehearsed for 2 days, but all sorts of things could have been undiscovered and about to go terribly wrong. And that all went fine. And as soon as we hit the main part of the set, everything just fell to pieces. And I don't even remember the rest of it because I was sort of troubleshooting as I was playing, trying to work out why has that happened? Is it my fault? Is it the sound man's fault? Did anybody else notice? Has it gone out on air? Who's getting sacked? I just came off and...
Well, you're also spinning another plate there. It's a live broadcast as well. Or it's being recorded for live broadcast. We had it at the Six Music Festival, didn't we, last year, doing the Big Balloon album.
Well, we weren't told which songs were going to be aired as well.
We
obviously
told.
It was the most ridiculous, progressive art pop songs.
Because I remember we had Liz Kershaw introducing us on stage, and it was just at that point where she messed up the first one. She did a second introduction, and they decided to go live at that very point. And we'd kind of been given like a heads up, like, you're live right now. It's like, we've got our five proggiest songs first. I wish you'd like, if they had told us this 3 hours ago, we could have like gone, right, okay, just the hits. They got Jules Holland's producer upstairs. You're thinking, oh, God.
And then, the rest is history regarding Jules Holland.
Indeed.
But to go back to, to add a Dutch Uncles festival, not low light, or funny story perhaps, our manager, we'd had a reasonable heavy night the night before.
It was at Glastonbury, wasn't it?
Glastonbury, yeah.
Yeah, so it was like, it took us 10 years to get booked for Glastonbury, and so it was like we were...
10 long, cold years.
We were very excited about it.
And bless him, our manager, who hadn't been in the job that long, we'd had a heavy night the night before, and he just didn't... We were camped behind the stage, we were playing the Williams Green stage, and he just didn't wake up.
We were on stage at about 5 p.m. as well. We hadn't seen him all day.
And he wasn't awake. There was no movement whatsoever. So the thinking was that he might be dead. At which point, we're sort of like, well, if he is dead, there's nothing we can do about it, really. If we check now, then and we find out he's dead, we're not going to be able to play Glastonbury. However, if we just leave it until afterwards, and he's still going to be dead.
Yeah.
So we'll deal with it then. At least we will have played Glastonbury. Our manager's dead. Two great stories.
Yeah, there we go.
The gig went really well, and fortunately... He wasn't quite dead.
Just very, very sweaty.
Yeah, you turned up in the second song, didn't you? I sort of looked over. Oh, thank God for that. You know, how are we going to explain that? You know. Yeah, yeah. So I just wanted to touch on as well a bit of news yesterday about Festival 6.
Yes.
Taking a break. Are you aware of that, the tweets that came out? Has anyone been to Festival 6 at all?
It's lovely.
Yeah, it's great. It's probably one of my favourite festivals. We've played it 3 times.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and we played in 2013, didn't we, together?
Yeah.
I think you were just after us, or a bit later on the
yeah.
day.
Yeah, 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 that was the same day as the Mannix and Chic, I think.
Yeah, that was it, wasn't it? And so it's unsustainable, they've said, to put the festival on in that location, which I can completely understand, because it was... To actually attempt something there, I think, is very, very admirable. But we had a really funny moment when we played it the second time, didn't we? In the woods.
Yeah,
well, again, technical problems. We were waiting 40 minutes for everything to get set up on the wood stage, weren't we? Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that stage anyway is a bit of a technical nightmare. Like every other year, it's been rained off because it's on a slope in the woods, so it can just become basically a river, you know, if it rains, which it does because it's North Wales in September. But when we played it, obviously, like, we were curating the stage, so we'd booked all the other bands. And every other band had overrun before us, so we were going on late anyway. And then we looked in the crowd and we saw Stuart McConey was front row, and we were like we knew like the band, but it's like, this is the first time he's actually going to watch us, and this is going to be great. And then we could see him like checking his watch. And
No, it wasn't that. It was like that.
Yeah.
Absolute nightmare stuff.
Oh, God. This is a recurring nightmare. Like, you get booked for a festival, and you've got a really good crowd, but you spend so long setting up that you never actually play. I mean, fortunately, we did play, but Stuart had gone by the time.
But back to the news side of the Festival Number 6 thing, I think it's a sad thing that it's going to stop, like, possibly forever. Because, I mean, I suppose it's just got too big for that place, and... I mean, really, they should have just kept they should have capped the capacity of it, I suppose, and just made it more and more expensive. I mean, every year that we did go, there were more and more champagne bars around the piazza. It was getting a bit like that, but that's fine. Yeah, people will pay for a good time and things like that. But, like, it's strange. Like, in terms of in terms of like conceptualized festivals, does the atmosphere of a festival make you think twice about where to take your show when you get gig offers, Will Goose?
Yeah, you know, we're playing in front of the Lovell Telescope tonight, and we filmed...
Is it your first time at Blue Dot?
No, we were here.
You should be like the house band here.
It's the first name on the team sheet, surely. Yeah.
We were here 2 years ago, which was great, and then 2 years before that, we played with New Order when they did their show here.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That was our first kind of like really big gig, so we were very nervous about that. We're obviously playing with Lovell Telescope here. We haven't done a couple of songs off the Race of Space for a while. For boring technical reasons, they weren't ready on the new setup, so I've been spending the last couple of weeks rectifying that, and you know, we had a special rehearsal yesterday, so it should
especially to be like disco rehearsal.
I mean, we normally don't have rehearsals.
Just a run through.
Yeah. No, we hadn't played for a month, so we thought we'd better do it, and also we can get a couple of old ones out of storage and see how they're going. So yeah, we've reworked one song in particular for tonight, and yeah, should be good fun.
Cool. Well, I mean, because I think it's strange. I don't think it's strange, but I think it's interesting that when conceptualized festivals such as this one and such as Number Six, they have to really sort of consider their headliners for the first 3 years, I suppose. And then once a festival's kind of gained traction, it is really hard to kind of go. It's either the festival calls it that and goes out with dignity, or they start just becoming every other festival, like sort of picking up the same bands. Like before you know it, it's another slot for Noel Gallagher. Is he playing? He's not playing this weekend, is he? Well, you know, it's like you start to get like the big mainstays just coming in and going, oh yeah, there's money in that. We'll get that now. So like, I don't know. I find it kind of sad, which is weird because we've always had a bit of a bitter feeling towards Number Six because our ex-booking agent used to curate it. And after he stopped working with us, he actually went out of his way to stop us being able to work.
So we got in the back door, though. We found different
ways.
Yeah,
we still managed to get in there with the Wood Stage and the Town Hall show.
Of course,
yeah, that was awful. Let's not... Should we talk about chips?
Talk about chips, okay.
We probably should. Are there any questions at this
point? Any questions at all?
I mean, it's just...
Oh, yeah, hold on.
I'll do Florence.
Go on, Andy. Watch out for your beer.
Oh. I'm going to do Florence and the Machine at Glastonbury.
Here we go.
Take your shoes off, then.
Just climbing up there.
Sometimes I feel like putting my hands up in the air.
Hello, sir.
Hi, I'm Steve.
I've
seen PSB many times and a fabulous band, and great to see you today. I was curious, I read a tweet from you a while back saying that the live album was still in the red, which seemed like a strangely granular thing to know about your own accounts. It must be so much like running a small business, which I don't think I'd ever really appreciated. You always think music is such a glamorous business.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misconceptions.
Yeah, it's not.
I think I speak for all of us on that.
Cheers,
one.
Mate.
I was speaking earlier about doing it DIY way. You know, we released the first two albums ourselves on our own label, and you do get a handle on money coming in and money very definitely going out. So, the Brixton thing, I think we viewed it as we'd release it. It'd probably cost a bit to do, but over time it would hopefully, you know, get into the black and not actually have cost money to do. But it did cost a lot of money. You know, we had to buy the rights for the footage. I think we had to pay the venue a fee. We didn't have to, but we felt it was right to go back and give performance fees to all the people who played that night because they weren't booked for a live album, they were booked for a one-off gig. So
that's very
all these
honest.
Things kind of like add up. And live albums don't sell particularly well compared to studio albums. So yeah, it's just, you know, when everyone, a lot of people have asked about the Royal Albert Hall and recording that gig, and it's, you know, I think I've heard it's £15,000 to film at the Royal Albert Hall, so...
It's crazy.
You know.
Yeah. Must be all the farts. Yeah.
That's quite a lot of red to start clawing back before you even started anything else, so I think it's not going to happen, sadly.
Any more?
Yeah, one more question.
Yeah?
I'll go.
No, it's my job. All right, go on. He's gone.
Sometimes I feel like...
Okay.
Sorry, I've just walked in. I'm just wondering if you were doing anything from the Titanic stuff that you did from the radio live shows the other day.
I think tied to Duncan's question about sort of site-specific stuff, I think we've gone space-heavy today, and then it's no use to anyone here because we're doing two other festivals this week, and we might throw one or two in at the other dates. But they're going to start kind of coming into the set more regularly. But I think today it is going to be, given the nature of the background, it's going to be... space and coal mining.
Yeah. You going to say something there, Neil?
No, I was going to be intrusive and say, how do you, I suppose obviously with
BBC thing. What made you choose Every Valley, I suppose, and what are you thinking of? Have you got like three or four ideas for the next record?
I think Every Valley was a combination of, as I said earlier, you know, wanting to do something that actually had a more human angle and had a bit more of a message and was ambitious in a different way. You know, the challenge of taking on a subject like that and trying to make a commercially semi-appealing album out of it, you know, because it'd be very easy to do a kind of industrial without any tunes kind of album, but I wanted to make it appealing and kind of try and bring people into what is quite an unappealing subject matter, I think, really. And, you know, the more pragmatic side of what we do is the material there, and the BFI have National Cobalt films, so there's all sorts of material that they had, and I think the combination of those two things just kind of got the ball rolling, and it just turned into what it turned into off the back of that.
Have you ever thought about doing a more directly political album? I see you written down here, we've got Brexit album.
No, that's my note.
All right.
Cheers, Andy. Brexit album?
I don't think
glad someone makes notes.
I've been asked that a couple of times. I don't think I could face listening to the voices I'd have to listen to day in and day out.
Oh, yeah, God.
Yeah.
Ooh. Well done.
It just makes me too sad.
Well, okay. Okay. So. Okay, so we've got about 10 minutes left, so we should really talk about chips, as we're a chips-based podcast. I suppose going full circle, going back to Twitter, you tweeted that you had some very strong chips opinion.
Does that go beyond ketchup or mayo?
I think I may have been over-egging. mixing my metaphors here, over-egging the pudding a bit. But, No, you know, I like a good chip. Describe a good chip.
Yeah. So we were chatting before about, sorry to leave her in a slightly north-south divide on the chip subject. But chips, and again, we are probably the home team here, but chips are better in the north than they are the south.
Is that right?
Talk to me.
Well, I mean, that's a statement. That's not a question. But, my family, my dad's side of the family's from Sunderland, and we used to go up there and sample the fish and chips by the seaside quite a lot as a kid, and they were always great. You're right. You know, I don't get too into the whole north south thing. I think you've got the whole kind of gravy culture, which is
the gravy
fantastic.
Culture.
And,
it's good fantastic, for a band.
And
great band.
Very envious of that. But yeah, you know, my wife's, she's not from the north, she's from the Midlands, which is definitely not the north, as I remind her frequently. But
so is that like more of a mushy peas?
Well, she's introduced me to like mushy peas, curry sauce, all these kind of things that you're not really in on as a southerner, I don't think. So I like to think my chip appreciation is quite well-rounded. It's not geographically isolated to, you know, the metropolitan bubble, the elite down in London.
basically, you don't mind a skin-on chip.
I don't, as long as it's not... soggy in the middle.
I went for some fish and chips in Islington recently, and it came with a big side salad. And I thought, that's just wrong, isn't it? You know,
the groans from everyone.
You're the wrong side of the river for a start. There, that's your problem there.
Okay, so I was linking it back to festivals as well. We'll probably talk about festival foods in general. I get asked this question quite a lot. In my work.
Because you really milk your session guitarist on
Tamika. I do. Well, basically, pretty much, I get asked a question a lot because I go into work and say, I play guitar for a band, you know.
And they don't know if you know. Pretty big deal.
And they go, oh, it must be really glamorous backstage. It must be really, food must be amazing. And it's not. It's absolutely horrible in most circumstances. So I thought we might, as well as festival lowlights, festival food lowlights, perhaps. Duncan's like, oh,
I think if they're bad, we can't name the festival. You know,
they've got
a lot of people to feed. But John, what's what's the worst festival food? Anything come to mind?
I'm not trying to give a political answer, a politician's answer here, but genuinely, the ones I can remember are the good ones. Like Bestival's food was always amazing. Camp Bestival as well.
Nando's
Park.
Oh, we did, yes, yeah.
The Hyde Park stuff, the BST stuff. The food there is. It's half the reason you do the gig, really.
We don't get asked to do those shows.
I don't know how we've got in on that, but... yeah, the catering is... I think it's pretty much half the deal. I can't... You know, we were in Portugal recently for Primavera there, and the food was disappointing.
Hello?
Strong Primavera contingent.
Hello. Yeah. I can't remember the Portuguese for hello. Obrigado, that's it. Thank you. I don't have any particular car crashes, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
sorry.
We've got loads.
Okay.
I think it's mainly because our tour manager is, he gets a bit hangry, doesn't he, Paul? And he very much looks forward to the meal when we arrive at a venue. And if it's disappointing, then we'll bear the brunt of that, basically.
Our tour manager's like that, actually. He's
very, I think they all are.
The harshest restaurant critic in the land.
Yeah, they really, really are.
So we have had some horrible food that he has quite rightly called out.
Gruel.
Yeah, we were at a festival once, and it wasn't even a long drive. I don't want to mention the festival, but I'm pretty sure it was mushroom risotto. And
been cooked for about 4 days.
And it was just horrible. And our tour manager, I think, maybe even threw it back at them or just screamed, "I'm not eating this junk," and just sort of ran off, didn't he? Or something like that.
What are we talking about? Can we bring some... I want to inject some positivity into this. Chips aside, who's the most interesting celebrity you've met on the festival circuit? Because it's... No. Headliner or just anyone, you know, just knocking around backstage in the VIP bar, something like that. Who's the most interesting? Or the one that sticks to mind?
I normally chicken out of approaching anyone like that. But our visuals man, Mr. B, collared me and Wayne Coyne when we played with them in Hull. And so I had a little chat with him, and I thanked him.
We were there, weren't we? Was that
The same day, yeah. So we had a little photo and a little chat. That was nice. He's a lovely man. And, he was just wandering around Hull City Centre in his full get-up all day, just sitting in a cafe in his red suit with his eye patch on, just having it.
Oh, I remember. We had that with Dexy from Dexy's Midnight Runners. Yeah. Is that his name? Oh, no, it's not his name.
Kevin Rowland.
Kevin Rowland. Thank you.
So close.
Whatever. We were talking about mushroom risotto 2 minutes ago. You should be thankful for this. So remember we played with the Proclaimers and Dexys in Teesside, didn't we? It was like Teesside
Stockton.
Calling.
Yeah.
Stockton. Was it Stockton Calling?
Sounds about right, yeah.
Is that the one? Yeah, and we just saw, like, we rocked up about midday, and he was already, like, it was like a festival in a car park, a bit like Primavera. Or not. Fine. It was just a festival in a car park, and obviously, you know, like, we were just behind the main stage, and it was absolutely blisteringly hot day, and he was just out there in a school chair with his full regalia, sort of, you know, dungarees and flat cap on, with sunglasses on, the biggest headphones you've ever seen, and also the biggest Greg's baguette, just having such a time on his own. It was like, just that level of contentment he had. I was like, wow.
I always feel
that
content when I've got a Greg's.
Look at that. I mean, if you can get through if you can go through it as long as he had and have that moment.
He did a 20-minute version of Come On Eileen, didn't he?
Did he?
World record.
I'm glad we missed that. But a friend of ours who played alongside The Cure at BST Hyde Park just a couple of weeks ago, he said that he met Robert Smith for like the first time. We saw the pictures, like, what was that like? And he went, it was really weird. He just kept talking about furniture arranging and things like that, like just having really down-to-earth basic conversations with Robert Smith, in full makeup, of course. It's just really startling. Like that's the moment where you get starstruck. I had it with Lauren Laverne when she told me about antihistamine creams, and all of a sudden you realise you're having a conversation with Lauren Laverne. It's really intense.
But off air as well, she was very passionate about her antihistamines.
Yeah, very passionate.
You're actually fine when we were being recorded. As soon as that red light went off, it was like, bloody hell, it's Lauren Laverne.
I've got to talk about my massive insect bites now.
Is it 12:45 yet?
Nearly. Okay, so we're about right. Any more questions for the guys before we wrap up? Anyone got any more?
Don't be shy.
No.
No, good.
No, that's fine. Well, okay. Thank you very much for coming late. It's more people than probably what we thought we'd get. That's great.
We've definitely skipped over some bits.
So just keep on listening to us. We're at Chips Chorton on Twitter. We try and get a podcast out every 3 weeks or so. So it's just generally what we've sort of done today. What time are you on, by the way, on the main stage?
7:30? It might be 7:00. 7:30, nodding.
your fans know, yeah. So go and catch public service later on. So thanks to Andy, thanks to Rob, thanks to Duncan, and a very big round of applause for John here from Public Service Broadcasting. And thank you very much
Woo!
For listening.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.